Tensions between strained South Asian neighbours, India and Pakistan, have again reached a fever pitch following an intense war of words between top diplomats of the two countries at the United Nations just recently. The heated exchange between Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and his Indian counterpart Subramaniam Jaishankar came after the UN Security Council issued a statement that warned of increasing dangers of terrorism. The two countries have often accused each other of terrorism and proxy war.
Speaking to reporters on the sideline of a UN Security Council meeting in New York on December 15, India's Foreign Minister Subramaniam Jaishankar called Pakistan the epicenter of terrorism. Earlier, the top Indian diplomat told the UN Security Council that his country faced the horrors of cross-border terrorism long before the world took serious note of it, in a veiled reference to Pakistan. On being asked to respond to his Indian counterpart's remarks, Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari said Indians continue to club Muslims and terrorists together. In a scathing counterattack, Zardari said Osama bin Laden is dead, but the butcher of Gujarat lives and he is the Prime Minister of India, referring to Narendra Modi. Modi was Chief Minister of the Western Indian state of Gujarat when an anti-Muslim pogrom in 2002 killed nearly 2,000 people. Zardari, the youngest foreign minister in the world, said his country had lost far more lives to terrorism than India, including his mother and foreign prime minister, Benazir Bhutto. Taking strong umbrage to the top Pakistani diplomat's diatribe, India's foreign ministry spokesman, Arindram Bakshi, called it a new low. He said Zardari's uncivilized outburst was the result of Pakistan's increasing inability to use terrorists and their proxies.
The ties between India and Pakistan have been strained by many issues, mainly the dispute over the Himalayan region of Kashmir. The two countries have fought three wars and engaged in umpteen cross-border skirmishes over the years. They have also frequently accused each other of terrorism. Since 2019 in particular, the two South Asian arch foes have ended all political and diplomatic contact following terrorist attacks in India as well as Pakistan and the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status by the Modi government.
The latest war of words between the officials of the two countries has to be seen in the context of political tensions that have rapidly escalated since February 2019 when a convoy of the Indian Army was attacked in Kashmir's Pulwama district, killing 46 soldiers. The attack was claimed by the Pakistan-based terrorist outfit Jaish-e-Mohammed. After that, India vowed to ensure the complete isolation of Pakistan. Islamabad has also accused India of carrying out attacks on the Pakistani soil. Last week, Pakistan's Deputy Foreign Minister Hina Rabbani Kaur said Islamabad has traced undeniable and indisputable links between India and acts of terrorism on Pakistani soil, and that the evidence was being formally shared with the United Nations, pertaining mainly to a deadly 2021 car bombing in the city of Lahore, among other incidents. However, the issue that has led to the near-total breakdown of political ties between the two countries was New Delhi's move to abrogate Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019. In September, during the 77th session of the UN General Assembly, Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif reiterated that sustainable peace and stability in South Asia is tied to a just and lasting solution to the Kashmir dispute. The Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi, however, has virtually closed the Kashmir file.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Sayyid Mohsin Abbas, a journalist and political commentator from London. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Abbas. Now, the top diplomats of India and Pakistan recently engaged in a war of words at the United Nations, with Mr. Zardari calling India's Prime Minister the butcher of Gujarat and Jaishankar referring to Pakistan as the epicenter of terrorism. Now, the question is, does this mark a new low in the Indo-Pak relations?
I think that India-Pakistan relationships at the best of times are fraught with huge difficulties and suspicion. That's just been the default position since 1947, when both countries were independent of Britain or the British Raj. Now, the latest spat that we've seen is interesting. Of course, it's a revisited sort of standard accusations and allegations of the past. I mean, the label of butcher of Gujarat is not something that's new. It's something that's been used and by all sorts of commentators. And it's a fact that Prime Minister Modi has been basically the overriding ruler of Gujarat at the time when huge massacres took place. And a lot of what happened at that time left a lot to be desired. And the suspicion certainly was that his background as an advocate and a supporter of Hindutva nationalism and his links to the RSS is it's on record as well. So all these things about the BJP, Hindutva fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism, and of course the links to the RSS leave Prime Minister Modi always vulnerable to these kinds of attacks and allegations. As far as the Indian side and their riposte or their kind of initial points about Pakistan and terrorism, again, these are standard old tropes that have been pushed about. The reality of the matter is that both nations have an interest in destabilizing the other, given that they have a nuclear standoff, given that they have a long-running dispute over Kashmir and many other issues.
Mr. Abbas, relations between the two strange South Asian neighbours have worsened since the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019. Do you see this deadlock breaking anytime soon?
No, there's no sign of that deadlock breaking. Kashmir is a real sticking point. On the one hand, of course, one knows that an army of almost a million, it's alleged, actually reside in Jammu and Kashmir, occupied Kashmir, as Pakistan would have it, and indeed as most of the Kashmiri population would have it. The Indians have continuously refused to give the plebiscite to the Kashmiris that are in their jurisdiction currently, on their side of the line of control. They've made life extremely difficult. They brutalized a lot of the population in the name of hunting down terrorists, alleged terrorists, but they've actually stuck curfews and created all sorts of traumas and terror in that province, no doubt about it. And the Kashmiris are unsatisfied, and we've seen cases of torture, arbitrary arrest, long-standing prisoners who have very little evidence against them necessarily, but political prisoners of conscience who are still languishing in Indian prisons. We've seen the harassment of women and children in Kashmir by the Indian occupying forces, and lots of other travesties that have taken place. Kunal Boshpuro was one example of rape of hundreds of Kashmiri women, for instance. But of course, this is no new thing. What is new in Kashmir is that the Indian, military and occupation forces have now the legal writ and the backup of the government itself, mainland Indian government, and they have the writ to essentially allow geoengineering.
So while Kashmir continues to be the main bone of contention between New Delhi and Islamabad, what are the other key issues or areas that make the relationship complex and fragile?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really territorial integrity other than Kashmir. I mean, we'd have to bring into question Balochistan. India had about 30 consulates in Afghanistan during the period that the Americans were occupying that nation. And India was very much online to being the key beneficiary of any American success in Afghanistan. And the idea was that they would embed themselves on the eastern borders of Pakistan, thereby giving them essentially a kind of an encirclement of Pakistan. That didn't really work in the end. The Indians' forces in their internal operation there in Afghanistan had to pack up their bags and leave as the Americans left. The Americans didn't really consult the Indians about it, which strained their relations. But what it hasn't stopped is India continuing to fund the likes of the Balochistan Liberation Army, which is on the borders of Afghanistan and Pakistan. That region is still being thrown into turmoil. And the significance is that Pakistan has in Balochistan probably the biggest amount of wealth in the entire nation of Pakistan. It's alleged that maybe $10-12 trillion of everything from black diamonds to copper to gold, as well as oil and gas, all exist in that territory of Balochistan. Hence, breaking Balochistan and balkanizing Pakistan is a major objective of Pakistan for some time. So Balochistan, Sindh and Punjab being separated, being destroyed would, as a composite body, would essentially defang Pakistan. So that's one major other area, and a huge struggle is going on there through the intelligence agencies, through sort of terrorist organizations, through sort of so-called liberation armies as well. So there's that, which is, I think, the major clash between the Indians and Pakistanis, other than Kashmir. Of course, they are competing rivals, even within the broader Belt and Road Initiative of China. So economically, China, being the huge power that it is and the emerging world superpower, if you like, desperately needs Pakistan at the moment, because they've got something called CPEC, a sort of road and rail transport system, which essentially allows China to export its goods via Pakistan to the port of Gwadar, which they built, the Chinese, and from there, obviously, distribute it around the world. Now, that makes really Pakistan a beneficiary of a huge potential economic, cash-in. And, that would be something which India is not very comfortable with. And India has its own links in the Chabahar port and is competing on that level. So this economic competition for gas, pipelines, oil pipeline routes, this need for, the territorial integrity of each nation to be maintained.
Last but not least, under the Narendra Modi-led BJP government, India has adopted a tougher stance on Kashmir while reversing confidence-building measures that were taken by previous governments. So do you see the Modi government as a hurdle in the improvement of Indo-Pak ties?
Without a doubt, the Modi government is a hindrance. I mean, their fundamental ideology and their means of coming to power has been based on really religious fundamentalism, and Hindu religious revivalism has been their ticket to power. And by this kind of revivalism, they maintain a political hold on a very large number of the population. And if they were to have soft policies with Pakistan, I don't think it would benefit the BJP. They require almost this kind of enemy, a Muslim enemy across the border that threatens their security as a way of winning votes and whipping up more support for themselves in the next election.
There you have it, Mr. Sayed Mohsen Abbas from London. He's a journalist and political commentator. Thank you for being on the programme, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Shazia Atamari, a member of Pakistan's National Assembly, praises Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari for his response to Indian counterpart at the UN, says Pakistan has lost thousands of lives to terrorism. Political scientist and journalist Shama Junejo cites Pakistan's Deputy Foreign Minister Hina Rabbani as saying that Islamabad provided dossiers to the UN on India's involvement in terrorism. Dhananjay Tripathi, who teaches at New Delhi-based South Asian University, notes that the war of words between the top diplomats of India and Pakistan at the UN is not good for diplomacy.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In a sign that the dominance of the US dollar is coming to an end, with the world economy getting divided into Eastern and Western blocs, India's rupee trade settlement mechanism has reportedly elicited interest from many countries apart from Russia. This mechanism is designed to use the rupee instead of the US dollar and other major world currencies for international transactions. It comes amid gradual erosion in the dollar's dominance as non-traditional reserve currencies like the rupee slowly take center stage.
A recent report by Reuters citing official documents and sources said several countries have come forward to discuss the rupee trade settlement mechanism with India, including Tajikistan, Cuba, Luxembourg, and Sudan. The mechanism was introduced in July is already functional, with sanctions mad at Russia making use of it. The report said the Narendra Modi government in New Delhi is looking to bring countries that are short of dollars into the mechanism, with four countries already showing interest in opening special rupee accounts called Vostro. Mauritius and Sri Lanka have also shown interest, the report stated, and their Vostro accounts have been approved by the Reserve Bank of India. The report further noted that India continues to discuss the denomination of trade in rupees with trading partners, including oil suppliers, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Details of a potential rupee dirham trade mechanism are being discussed by Indian and Emirati bankers, while talks with Saudi Arabia on a rupee rial trade mechanism are also underway. These developments suggest that India's central bank is trying to bypass the U.S. dollar for trade with countries amid rapidly shifting geopolitical dynamics, especially after the Ukraine war. The experiment has so far worked well with Russia.
The introduction of the rupee trade settlement mechanism, according to industry observers, is designed to remove bottlenecks involved in the import and export of goods and services which require payments in US dollars as the world's reserve currency. That, in turn, comes with the risk of forex rate fluctuations. That's where trade settlements in rupees comes as a panacea, removing risks involved with the US dollar. Instead of transactions in American currency, the invoice will be done in Indian currency if the other parties have a Vostro account.
Reserve Bank of India, the central banking institution that manages the country's major monetary policies, on July 11 unveiled the rupee settlement system for international trade aimed at boosting trade with other countries with a focus on exports from India. The mechanism took immediate effect and required banks to seek prior approval. A notification issued by the Reserve Bank of India said the move was taken to promote the growth of global trade with emphasis on exports from India and to support the increasing interest of the global trading community in Indian rupees. It said all exports and imports under the invoicing arrangement may be denominated and invoiced in rupee, while the exchange rate between the currencies of the two trading partner countries may be market determined. Many observers say the decision to allow international trade in rupees is aimed at facilitating trade with Sri Lanka, which is running low on forex reserves, and Russia, which has been slapped with sanctions by Western countries. It has also opened a window of opportunity for India and Iran to consider bilateral trade with a rupee-rial arrangement, which was one of the issues discussed by Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri during his recent visit to New Delhi.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Andrei Kortanov from Moscow, the Director General of Russian International Affairs Council. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Kortanov. Now, India's rupee trade settlement mechanism is reportedly generating interest from many countries. So how important is it to end the dominance of the US dollar in global trade?
Well, the special position of the US currency creates opportunities for the United States to dominate the global financial system and to impose secondary sanctions or extraterritorial sanctions on countries which are willing to trade with Russia. If you shift to local currencies, of course it means that the power of the United States is reduced. So if Russia is concerned about these type of sanctions, and it should be, it is in Russia's interest to shift to currencies other than dollar.
So, sir, Russia has already been using this mechanism following the imposition of sanctions in the wake of the Ukraine war. So, which countries would benefit from it the most?
Well, what we observe since the beginning of this century is a very gradual, very incremental decline of dollar as the major exchange and reserve currency in the global finance. It went down from approximately 70% of global currency reserves to less than 60%. So there is a decline, but it's not a very steep decline. And many countries would like to limit the use of dollar in their foreign trade and also to limit dollar as a reserve currency in their financial systems. Probably the most important change is the decision of China to gradually decouple itself from the dollar financial system. China is selling out U.S. Treasury bonds, and it is shifting its trade with Russia to RMB, to the Chinese currency. There are some other countries.
Mr. Khotanov, during Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri's recent visit to New Delhi, the issue of rupee-rial trade figured prominently in discussions. So how feasible is this plan?
You know, I think that it is difficult to imagine that such a plan can be implemented very fast, within a couple of months or even within a couple of years. There is a lot of inertia within the financial system. There's a lot of inertia within the private sector. So I think that even if this process is underway, it will take many years before the fundamentals of the global international system are likely to change. And definitely, you know, Iran and India can agree on some specific bilateral arrangements. I think that since Iran is under U.S. sanctions, that might make it easier for Indians to trade with Iranians. But this is not a fast process. It will take time.
Last but not least, sir, India has in recent months significantly ramped up oil imports from Russia, defying Western sanctions. This rupee trade mechanism is another indication that the country prioritizes its own interests. So does this point to India's growing international clout as an emerging economic power?
To some extent, yes. I think that India wants to make sure that it will follow its own interests, both political and economic interests, and it will not take orders from Washington, D.C. However, India definitely has very vast economic relations with the United States and with the West at large. It doesn't want to sacrifice this relationship. So the challenge for India is to keep a proper balance between the East and the West, between the Indo-Pacific region and Greater Eurasia. It will require a lot of diplomatic skills and a lot of balancing in its trade, in its investment, in its technological relations. So it will really be quite challenging for the Indian foreign policy, but I'm sure that India can make it.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Andrei Khotanov from Moscow for being on the program. He's a Director General of Russian International Affairs Council. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Journalist Nikunj Ohri cites the Reuters report that states that India's rupee trade settlement mechanism has attracted interest from countries such as Tajikistan, Cuba, Luxembourg, and Sudan. Anshul Saxena, a political analyst, says Sri Lanka is set to use Indian rupee for international trade, and the country's apex bank is waiting for Indian central bank's approval to designate rupee as Sri Lanka's foreign currency. Michael Ashura, a geopolitical commentator, points to the trend of de-dollarization in international transactions, as Sri Lanka is already using the rupee, while other countries are in talks about rupee mechanism.
And that was our episode about the Indian and Pakistani foreign ministers trading barbs at the UN and India's rupee trade mechanism, eliciting interest from many countries. Now, we shall meet again, same time, same day, next week. So till then, take great care.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
There are reports that Chile plans to open embassy in Palestine. Chilean President Gabriel Boric has said that his move aims to give Palestinians representation and respect under international law. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tehran Times wrote in this regard, Chilean President Gabriel Boric has announced that his country will open an embassy in the occupied West Bank. It is a courageous move amid Western pressure campaigns to lure the representation of sovereign countries in occupied Palestine. But Boric has said that his government's decision is to respect international law. Chile's president made the remarks in a private ceremony with a delegation representing the Palestinian diaspora in the capital, Santiago, and the country. The leftist leader has repeated the expressed support for the Palestinian people's demand for an independent state. He said, "I think we didn't make it public. I'm taking a risk with this announcement, but we're going to upgrade Chile's official representation in Palestine from the business manager we have today to an embassy we will open during our term to give Chile the representation it deserves and be present in all the diplomatic spaces in the occupied Palestinian territories." Boric's latest remarks in support of the Palestinian cause came after diplomatic tensions with the Zionist regime, when the Chilean leader suspended a meeting to accept the recently appointed Israeli regime ambassador to the South African country. At the time, the Chilean presidential office said this was in response to the murder of a Palestinian teenager on September 15th by Israeli regime forces. The Zionist regime condemned the decision, saying it seriously harmed bilateral ties. In 2017, former U.S. President Donald Trump drew the ire of Palestinians and the international community when he recognized the Zionist regime's claim to Al-Quds and, a year later, moved the U.S. embassy from the settlement of Tel Aviv to the Holy City. Trump, a staunch Zionist supporter, also shut down a U.S. consulate in occupied Al-Quds, which for years had served as the de facto embassy for Palestinians. While Trump's successor Joe Biden promised to reopen the consulate, his administration, similar to many other measures taken by Trump, has yet to do so amid opposition from the Zionist regime officials. Biden has kept the U.S. embassy in the city of Al-Quds as well, in more measures undertaken by his predecessor that he had pledged to overturn when running for president but has failed to do so. Borik told the Palestinian delegation that their community in Chile can count on him as a friend, saying something basic and simple that today is not being followed is to respect international law. From this deep conviction, be aware that you can count on a friend here, that I respect your traditions, and please don't misunderstand this, but we take these actions with love and, with my case, the acknowledgement of the dignity of people, which is what's appropriate. The comments drew applause from the attendees. During the meeting, the president of the Palestinian community in Chile, Maurice Khamis, told the leftist leader, "We are sibling countries and peoples. Let's hope that this star keeps lightening our path to peace, justice, freedom, and a way back to social justice and a fairer world." Borik's announcement came at the annual Christmas tree lightning event attended by members of the Palestinian community in the Andean country. Santiago says that during Boric's term in office, his government will upgrade the current diplomatic mission to give Chile the representation it deserves with an embassy. During his speech at September's UN Assembly, Boric displayed his support for the Palestinian people when he told the international community not to normalize Israeli abuses and human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories. While there is widespread support among Latin American nations for Palestine, Chile's plans to open an embassy in the Palestinian territories will make the Andean country one of only a handful to have an embassy-level office in the occupied West Bank and is expected to draw anger from the Zionist regime authorities. However, experts say the move could encourage others in Latin America to follow suit. Chilean Foreign Minister Antonio Orejuela confirmed the plan but said there was no timeline in place as of yet. While Boric said the proposed embassy in the occupied Palestinian territories was also meant to give Palestinians the representation they deserve, he did not specify the exact location of the embassy. The announcement by Boric, who assumed his four-year term in March 2022, will boost the level of the country's current official representation in Palestine to an embassy. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates strongly praised the move, saying it affirms the principal position of Chile and its president in support of international law and the right of the Palestinian people to re-establish their independent state. Chile has the largest Palestinian population outside the West Asia region, estimated at more than 300,000, and has a major soccer club called Palestino, founded following the founding of the Zionist entity, and is now watched by thousands of fans in Chile and Palestine. In 1998, Chile opened a representative office to Palestine in Ramallah, and in 2011 recognized Palestine as a state and supported its entrance to UNESCO. The announcement comes at a time when the occupied West Bank is experiencing some of the worst levels of violence by the Zionist regime in more than a decade this year, much of it concentrated around Jenin and the nearby city of Nablus. Israeli regime forces have murdered at least 150 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, while more than 20 Israeli settlers have died in retaliatory operations in both the occupied West Bank and the occupied Palestinian territories. The Zionist regime forces recently murdered another Palestinian during one of its now near daily nighttime raids near a flashpoint site, underlining the continuing violence in the occupied West Bank. Recently, three Zionist forces were wounded and a Palestinian was killed in a retaliatory operation. According to local sources, five Palestinians have also sustained injuries in an attack by Israeli settlers on Palestinian vehicles in the town of Huwara, which is to the south of Nablus. According to reports, Palestinian activists who document settler violence say a group of Israeli settlers hurled rocks at vehicles and sprayed Palestinian passengers with pepper gas in the town, injuring five of them and causing damage to the town's vehicles. The injured were treated nearby by local medics, as the town is under Israeli regime military occupation. Israeli settler violence against Palestinians and their property is commonplace in the occupied West Bank and has almost never been prosecuted by the Zionist regime authorities. This violence is expected to increase with the incoming Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's incoming cabinet. There are more than 600,000 Israeli settlers illegally occupying portions of the West Bank in violation of international law and established norms prohibiting the relocation of the occupying power's civil population to the land of the occupied. This is also expected to rise as Netanyahu has secured a coalition with extremist Zionist and far-right extremist partners who oppose Palestinian statehood and want to strongly expand Zionist settlements in the occupied West Bank. This is in violation of international law and goes against multiple UN resolutions. During his term in Chile's parliament, Boric supported a bill that proposed the boycotting of Israeli goods from the territories occupied by the Zionist regime since 1967, including the holy city of Al-Quds. Palestinian immigration to Chile began in late 19th century with waves coming after Nakba, an Arabic word meaning catastrophe and refers to the start of Israel's ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948, and when the Zionist regime was created, following Britain's Balfour Declaration in 1917. What followed was waves of migrants from Europe and the US regime that set up settler units in the occupied Palestinian territories. Middle East Eye had an eye on this issue, writing, "The Palestinian Foreign Ministry praised the decision by Chilean president, which it said affirms the principal position of Chile and its president in support of international law and the right of the Palestinian people to establish their independent state," according to Palestinian news agency Wafa. The Israeli regime embassy in Chile and foreign ministry have not commented on the decision. Chile's Palestinian community is estimated to include 300,000 people, most coming from the Beit Lahm area in the occupied West Bank, including the villages of Beit Jala and Beit Sahur. Chile previously opened a representative office in Ramallah in 1998, and in 2011 it recognized Palestine as a state and supported it joining UNESCO. The Chilean president has not said where the location of the new embassy would be, but the choice could be symbolic. Chile would then join only a handful of other embassies that have offices in Palestine.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran. for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. This is Zainab Askari, and today we're going to discuss about self-awareness and four relationships regarding children. And on that note, today in our studio we have with us Professor Salman Naqavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, as we have been talking about the stages of adolescence and what kind of things parents got to be taking care of in this stage, what about self-awareness? Because self-awareness is very, very important. As Imam Ali Lisan puts it, that the one who knows himself knows his Lord. So that importance is necessary. How do we develop self-awareness in our adolescence?
Yes, thank you very much. Previously, we talked about that and touched upon the issue that basically when we want to develop the various relationships in our lives, the starting point would be from ourselves. And we have to understand ourselves and know what we are, what are the faculties that we have, the inner faculties, the outer faculties, and the various aspects of our existence, whether it is mental, spiritual, or physical. And we have to understand all these facets, so we have to try to get a complete picture of the human being, of ourselves, and realize what is in store for us, what Allah Almighty has created in us. Because He praises Himself when He says, لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي أَحْسَنِ تَقْوِيمٍ.
Yeah.
He praises and glorifies Himself and says that I've created the human being in the best of ways.
Best of its forms.
So the manifestation of God's will and power and knowledge is the creation of the human being.
Yeah.
And one should realize that. Unfortunately, when our children, our teenagers, go to school nowadays, they are taught about science and they are very much surprised or very much belittled by the science they study, and they think everything is based on science and everything that has been created out of nowhere. There's no need for some intelligent being to design all of this, because there's so much emphasis on science. So science has become a god itself today.
Yeah.
And one of the issues that we are facing today in the society generally, amongst teenagers, even teenagers, they're not even ready to accept the existence of God, unfortunately, in some cases. And this is because of the lack of the relationship that has to be created between ourselves and our Lord, Allah Almighty.
Yeah.
If we were able to teach our children, our teenagers, from the beginning, that whatever has been created in this world has been created by Allah Almighty. Though, yes, everything has a natural process. Everything that is in nature does not mean that it has come into existence on its own, especially our very existence. The human being is not just a physical being. It is not just a physical pure being. It has something which is beyond
its being, yeah.
Today we are talking about human consciousness. Human consciousness cannot be described without understanding the linkage between the human being and his Lord.
Yeah, we'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab and I'm with Professor Naqavi. We are discussing about self-awareness and the relationships that need to be developed in an adolescent. Yeah.
So we were mentioning the faculties, especially the inner faculties, and that is the mental capabilities that the human beings have. We all human beings have been bestowed by Allah Almighty by the thinking faculty, the reasoning faculty, the intellect. And as I mentioned before, it is the intellect which takes us to our Lord. Ma abida bihir rahman wa tusiba bihil jinan. If we want to be a servant of Allah Almighty, if we want to worship Him, if we want to praise Him, if we want to glorify Him, it is through our intellect.
Yes.
If we want to achieve the heavens, if we want to become achieve salvation in this world and the hereafter, it is because of the aql, because of the intellect. Unfortunately, today, when we are listening to many people, laymen, teenagers, the youth, they often, when you talk to them, they say, oh, that seems to be very logical, or that seems to be very illogical. That's reasonable or that's not reasonable. But the question is, how do they define that? Have our teenagers been taught to think properly, to understand what the facts are, what the truth is, how to understand what the truth is? It becomes, as I said, from ourselves. We have to realize what the truth is from within and then reach out to the absolute truth, that the ultimate infinite truth, Allah Almighty.
Yeah.
And that requires the proper use of the intellectual faculty. Thinking is trying to discover things which are unknown to us. How do we reason? How do we argue? How we define things in a way that the truth is clear for us? It becomes clear, abundantly clear, what the truth is. So there's a great deal of effort which has to be put into understanding and realizing the truth. Our teenagers, whether at home or at school, have to be taught to think and reason properly.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are always two aspects to thinking, which is important. One is taken care of by logic, thinking yeah. logically. When you think logically, it means either of two things. If you are reasonable, it means two things. One is the reasoning should be valid. And the other is the reasoning should be sound. Now, you may have valid reasoning, but it may not be sound, or you may have sound reasoning, but it may
not be valid.
When is it valid? When it follows the rules of formal logic, how you present your argument, how you place the concepts and link them together, and how you put the premises together. When you say A is equal to B, B is equal to C, therefore A is equal to
C.
This is how you present an argument in the mathematical way. But
in a logical way. Yeah.
So this is makes your argument valid.
Yeah.
Because the form of your argument is correct.
Yeah.
But to make it sound, the matter which goes into that form has to be also correct and according to the truth. You have to start off from premises which are self-evident, and we have to be able to build up arguments based on that. So we have to learn and teach our teenagers to be thinking in a valid way, in a sound way.
Yeah. Well, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Tell us there. Stay tuned with us.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing, and today we're talking about human faculty intelligence and how you can develop that, how you can actually boost it in your teenagers. Well, intellect is not only the dimension of intelligence that exists in human beings. Your ability to see every dimension of life depends on the keenness of your intelligence. That's what you have been telling us so far. Yes.
Yes, being an intellectual and being intelligent, both are important. Intelligence leads us to think quickly, achieve results quickly. Being intellectual makes us think deeply.
Yeah.
The problem is when you, for example, start, we are not able to discern and differentiate between valid and sound reasoning and fallacious reasoning. We come up with results which are uncomforting. I mean, today when you think of, when you talk to the youth, they would argue, where did we come from? How did human beings come into existence? They've been taught the theory of evolution. And
yeah.
The theory of evolution may be correct or may not be correct, but that's not the issue. Even if it is correct, it cannot be accepted without the existence of God.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, today our youth, the teenagers, are not taught how to relate the scientific facts with the ultimate and absolute facts of life which exist in the universe.
So there's a relation between the creator and the creation.
Exactly.
And this relation has to be taught.
So if we want our children to, for example, we are faced today with issues. Of course, as we mentioned, there are changes coming about in adolescence, and they have hormonal changes coming within, and they have physical changes, apparent changes coming in their body. They feel surprised about that. They feel amazed by that. So they need to be given comfort. They may not be able to think properly because they are facing physiological and physiological changes. They are facing physical changes. They have emotional stresses. The hormones are creating a great deal of emotions in them, which they may not be able to manage and control. And they think less and feel more. And that is the situation. Of course, that is something which we are doing even in a later stage of life as adults. We think less and feel more. We are more emotional than thinking beings, whereas the human being is distinct because of his thinking faculty. But the tender age and the sensitive age of adolescence is very, very difficult to manage for the adolescent himself or herself. So it is up to their parents to facilitate that and to help them go through that age, through that stage. It is a very difficult stage. The parents would fear that their children are getting caught up in things which they should not be doing. God forbid, sex, drugs, narcotics. These are things which are being faced by society today in many places of the world, even in Islamic societies. And this is something which has to be controlled and managed. Now, of course, the problem is that when you talk to an adolescent and a teenager, he's coming to a stage where he wants to become independent.
Yeah.
So that is very difficult to deal with him.
So in order to know how to deal with an independent adolescent now, we need some teachings, we need some more sessions for that. Thank you so much, Professor Naghavi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, please go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. If you have any questions, any suggestions, any comments for our program, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. And when you go to our official website, parstoday.com, you'll find a tab Call of Islam. Over there, you can find our programs. Until another session, fi amanullah, God bless you all.
Do you know Islam says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a call.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is I.